Kingdom. That does it for our broadcast. Very special thanks to the amazing team that put this broadcast together. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm. to verify that a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Black community organizers are calling on Portland to declare a state of emergency about gun violence. The state of Washington will put up $1 billion to replace the interstate bridge. And the effort to bring adult students back to local campuses after they quit school to work during the pandemic. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 10th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. As Portland's fatal shootings continue to fall disproportionately on people of color, community leaders are demanding the city declare a state of emergency about gun violence. They also want $10 million of local, state, and federal money invested in community groups to help solve the problem. Community organizers gathered yesterday at Dawson Park, the scene of the shooting deaths of at least three people within the last 15 months. At least 92 people were killed in Portland's murders in 2021, shattering all previous records. The city's now on track to outpace even that total this year. Washington State earmarks $1 billion to replace the I-5 bridge. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
Washington lawmakers plan to set aside $1 billion to replace the Interstate 5 bridge between that state and Oregon. The allotment is part of a nearly $17 billion transportation package that lawmakers have been negotiating for months. The proposal, which became public yesterday, still needs to go to a vote in the Washington legislature and get the governor's signature. Construction on the bridge originally began in 1915, and it now has the potential to collapse during a major earthquake. Discussions to replace the bridge date back to at least the 1980s. Replacing the bridge has an estimated cost of somewhere between $3.2 and $4.8 billion. Washington, Oregon, and the federal government will all cover parts of the cost. The U.S. government's $1.2 trillion infrastructure package, which passed in January, earmarks about $40 billion for bridges. Washington's allotment is less than anticipated. The state was supposed to give about $200 million more. Funding was adjusted downward when an export tax on gasoline and diesel failed to materialize. The Oregon legislature has not said where our state's portion will come from. Tolls are still a possibility. Oregon has questioned Washington's commitment to paying for the new bridge. In 2013, after years of planning the project known as the Columbia River Crossing, the Washington State Senate refused to pass a funding package to replace it. I-5 carries a major load of traffic between the states. In 2019, more than 143,000 vehicles crossed the bridge daily. Plans to discuss other decisions on other important aspects of the bridge will now be ramped up. Questions such as whether it will be a double-decker bridge, how many lanes it may have, how it will connect to Hayden Island, and what kind of mass transit options it may include, all remain. Oregon Representative Susan McClain, Democrat Hillsborough, said, quote, "Washington has started this process, and now it's important for us to make a commitment," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
More than 30,000 students attend Mount Hood Community College. When the pandemic hit, many adult students decided to go back to work. Now, a collaboration with two Oregon community colleges is exploring how to bring them back to the campuses. KBOO's Bronwyn Clark has the story.
The pandemic has contributed to a significant drop in enrollment at community colleges. Two colleges in Oregon are exploring how to bring students back to campus, especially adult learners. Mount Hood Community College has received a $30,000 grant from New America Center on Education and Labor to explore why adult students have left school. John Hamlin is the Vice President of Student Development at Mount Hood Community College. Hamlin says, when the pandemic hit, many had no choice but to go back to work. He says the biggest issues for this population, even before the pandemic, were time and money.
The cost of college is significant, and if they do need to work, having the time to go to school and being able to just leave their job and come to school is just not always an option available for students.
Hamblin says Mount Hood has identified a pot of funding it can use to help students with small financial barriers so they can stay enrolled or re-enroll. The college has sent out a survey to 10,000 students to explore the issue of keeping them in school. Rural colleges have faced a different set of challenges during the pandemic. Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay is also partnering with New America. Jared Gardner, the school's Dean of Student Success, says the rural broadband infrastructure in the region is poor, making virtual classes difficult, if not impossible. But just like Mount Hood, Gardner says finances present a challenge for many students.
One of the things that we say around here is that our students are one flat tire away from dropping out. So if we can provide that emergency fund from time to time that can get over those little barriers, then that can help our students out a ton.
Gardner says Southwestern Oregon Community College is collaborating with New America to explore ways to reach out and engage adult students. He says higher education institutions have been honed to serve traditional students just out of high school, but they are a shrinking slice of people enrolled.
I'm really looking forward to how this grant can help us to be able to serve the new traditional student, the post-traditional student. That's a majority of our students and some majority of our community members, and that's what puts the community in community college.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Bronwyn Clark.
The Washington State Redistricting Commission voted against intervening in a federal challenge to the state's new voting maps. As Eric Tegedoff reports, a challenge to redistricting in the Yakima region could still mean changes beyond this year's election.
Concerns are lingering over the final voting maps approved in Washington State. While the districts are set for the 2022 election, legislative redistricting in South Central Washington is being challenged under the Federal Voting Rights Act. The lawsuit alleges the map creates the facade of a district that contains a majority of people of Latin heritage. Andrew Hong is with Redistricting Justice for Washington, a group representing a coalition of communities of color. He says the line between districts 14 and 15 splits the Yakima Reservation from the largest Latino community in Washington.
This is a community that is working class, that has been historically marginalized and disenfranchised, and the Voting Rights Act protects the voting rights of these communities to have a district where they can elect candidates that represent them, and the State Redistricting Commission denied them.
Democratic members of the Washington State Redistricting Commission have voted against defending the new maps. The commission's nonpartisan chair resigned this week, saying the members had undermined the redistricting process with their vote not to defend them. Joe Fain, a Republican commissioner, has said the refusal to defend the maps tarnished the bipartisan process. Hong's organization was more pleased with the congressional map, which largely kept majority communities of color districts intact in the Seattle area. But back on the state level, the group also has concerns about districts in Snohomish and Pierce counties. He says this round of redistricting has highlighted the need for change in how the process is done, as well as a better understanding of it.
We think of elections and campaigns as the way we elect our representatives. The step that goes before that, that people overlook, is redistricting, which is the process of our states choosing the lines in which people will elect their representatives.
Last month, the commission admitted to violating the Open Public Meetings Act at the end of the redistricting process in November, when it made decisions behind closed doors as the deadline for maps approached. A hearing for the Federal Voting Rights Act challenge in South Central Washington is scheduled for March 25th. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
We are about to spring forward on those clocks. So today, I checked in with a local sleep expert about how to make it less painful.
So it's Kimberly Hutchison, and I'm an associate professor of neurology and sleep medicine at OHSU in Portland, Oregon. And I have a website at www.kimberlymd.com.
Perfect. Okay. Well, what's your best words of wisdom for us as we're heading into changing our clocks?
Sure. So I think, you know, as a sleep physician and a person who cares immensely about her sleep time and quality, my best piece of advice is really the proper mindset. So realizing that it can take some time to adjust to the change in our clocks. And this could be, for most people, a couple of days, but for some people, up to a week or more. And that you're just not going to feel your best. And that may mean that you may be more tired, you may be less motivated, you may have a worse mood, and that this is all normal and it too will pass. So being compassionate with yourself and know that on the other side of this is more daylight and the fresh start of spring, and just, you know, thinking about in advance, like how you're going to cope with this sort of decrease in motivation and sleep loss. So that's kind of my main thing. I do have some, you know, points about what you can do to kind of decrease the impact of this change, but recognizing that we are, it is normal to feel this at this time of year, and just accepting that is my number one piece of advice.
Okay. Walk me through the steps before, you know, the days leading up and the days after.
Sure. So adjusting your schedule slowly has benefits. And so if you can start by advancing your schedule by about 15 minutes per day, starting several days, I mean, there's no hard science on when you should start, but at least a few days before starting to advance your schedule by roughly 15 minute increments. And this would mean sort of going to bed about 15 minutes early and getting up about 15 minutes earlier than your average time. And this is assuming that you have a pretty routine sleep schedule that you can, you know, adjust in a meaningful way like that. For example, I agreed to do a 7:30 a.m. live interview on the news tomorrow morning, which I normally wouldn't do because it's too early to be up and on live TV for me. However, knowing that daylight savings time is coming on Sunday, it will be in my best interest to go ahead and get up and start, you know, preparing for work and being ready to go at that hour. So the main, you know, as we move through the shift in the clock time, it's important to try to continue to get up at the same time and not allow yourself, you know, to sleep in, say, an extra hour, and then come Monday when it's time to go to work, then you're having to, that entire hour is being lost at once. But instead, spreading it out, and then when it comes time to go to bed on Sunday night and get up on Monday morning, the impact is less.
Okay. And then in the days after, if you're just feeling crummy because of the schedule change, what is your advice in that situation?
I would maximize your management of light in your life. So the best thing would be to expose yourself to early morning sunlight and bright lights, and then decreasing your exposure to light in the evening. And so in particular, that would mean not using any screens or devices for at least 2 hours before your new bedtime. And if needed, wear some like blue blocking glasses and, you know, dimming your house lights and things so that your brain starts to accept that it's getting darker and that evening is sort of coming sooner, and vice versa for the morning. So having yourself up and sometimes people will use artificial lights or just getting outside if the sun is shining and turning your face towards the sun for a few minutes will help to adjust your body clock. You also want to minimize, like, if you're feeling tired and groggy, you know, maybe a 10 or 15 minute nap early in the day if it's really impacting your ability to function. Otherwise, I would recommend avoiding napping because you want to increase your sleep pressure so that you can fall asleep earlier at the new time that night.
Okay. And what are some of the more serious impacts that this time change can have on our bodies? I mean, it's not just feeling groggy. For some people, it can get pretty serious, is my understanding, right?
Well, I mean, the most serious thing that I can think of would be drowsiness and driving early in the morning and, you know, getting into an accident because you're not able to focus. And then, you know, throughout this time, there are, you know, certain tasks that require full concentration. And if you're not able to concentrate, then you may be less likely to make good decisions. We also know that the sleep deprivation that comes with losing an hour of sleep can impact our insight and judgment. Our frontal lobes tend to be impaired preferentially when we are sleep deprived, and it's our frontal lobes that help us to sort of weigh risks and benefits and make good decisions. So if those aren't working properly, then you're more likely to make mistakes or just risky decisions, and that can lead to dangerous outcomes.
Sure. Okay. Well, anything else I have not asked you that you would like to touch on?
The only thing is that, you know, the kind of the impact of the daylight savings time is twofold, in that we lose an hour of sleep, so we can end up being sleep deprived, but also this shift in our daily schedule and our sort of body's 24-hour clock. And so it's that part that is usually takes longer to overcome. And other things that you can do to help with the new, setting the new schedule would be shifting your meal times as well. So if you're moving your clock forward, you want to make sure that you're eating lunch, eating dinner, and all of those things at the time or the new set time, because those other cues also help to influence your body's sleep schedule and your natural rhythms. And so you're more likely to be tired and fall asleep. You don't want to not recognize that, you know, you're all of a sudden also eating later and going to bed later, and then you're expecting yourself to fall asleep earlier. Like, those things don't really go together. Everything needs to sort of shift together as far as your eating and sleeping schedules.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so very much. I really appreciate you joining me today.
Yeah, sure thing.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 10, Radio Lost and Found. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy skies early, then partly cloudy after midnight, a low down to 33. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy, a high of 58. The weekend's bringing a good chance of rain both Saturday and Sunday with highs in the low 50s. Today in history, on this date in 1876, the first speech was transmitted by telephone. And our quote of the day is from Alexander Graham Bell, who spoke those first words on the phone, saying, quote, "Mr. Watson, come here. I want you." In a recent national survey, roughly half of college students who responded conveyed symptoms of depression or anxiety. Suicide rates among college students have become a big concern in many states, as Mike Moen reports is prompting calls for mental health resources on campuses.
The academic year is winding down for college students, and in South Dakota, some might notice a more responsive campus in terms of suicide prevention when they return this fall. A new program helps schools evaluate mental health resources. For nearly 12 years, the group Lost and Found has carried out suicide prevention programs for young adults in South Dakota. It now offers a campus resilience index where a scorecard lays out prevention capacity for participating schools. Executive Director Eric Muckey says this tool allows administrators to see where they might have strengths as well as gaps.
What successful results could look like from this index is certainly more counselors, but the other side of this is also really focused on training. How many students are trained to provide peer support?
In measuring each school, the index uses a CDC model that details suicide prevention strategies for campus settings. Muckey says they're preparing recommendations for one school right now and hope to soon evaluate as many as 8 other campuses in South Dakota and Minnesota. State health officials say the age group with the highest suicide rate is 20 to 29. And national surveys indicate a rising number of college students reporting symptoms of depression and anxiety. Muckey adds the pandemic has brought more stress at a time when these young adults are trying to adjust to college life.
Especially for students who are first-generation college students or for students who might already be presenting with mental health conditions before they arrive on campus. And so all of those factors connected all contribute to this underlying issue.
He worries the effects of social media, such as isolation, are a contributing factor as well. Efforts to expand the Campus Resilience Index recently got a boost through a new grant awarded by the South Dakota Community Foundation. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
The U.S. rejects Poland's plan to transfer fighter jets. Congress proposes sending Ukraine $13.6 billion in military and humanitarian aid. And the Biden administration may extend a freeze on student loan payments. With more on the stories impacting our democracy in these historic times, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The prospect of fighter jets at the disposal of the United States government departing from a U.S. NATO base in Germany to fly into airspace contested with Russia over Ukraine raises some serious concerns for the entire NATO alliance.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about the administration rejecting Poland's offer to transfer Russian-made fighter jets to the U.S. to replenish Ukraine's air forces. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki acknowledged logistical issues with providing Ukraine security aid.
How do you get planes into Ukraine in a way that is not escalatory? And what are the logistics and operational details of that? Those are conversations are happening between counterparts at the military.
At least 516 civilians have been killed in Ukraine since the start of Russia's invasion, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reported. A bill moving through Congress would funnel $13.6 billion toward military and humanitarian aid in Ukraine. Lawmakers are expected to pass the legislation this week, as well as a spending package to fund the government for the next 8 months and avoid a shutdown. Universal free meals at schools are slated to end this summer, after a provision to extend temporary pandemic programs was not included. Oil prices tumbled Wednesday when a United Arab Emirates official urged an OPEC production increase, explained Antonia Juhas, author of The Tyranny of Oil, the world's most powerful industry.
The reality is right now, the expectation is that there will be a reduction in supply of Russian oil on the global market, of Russian natural gas, because Putin has already been using the supply of natural gas as a tool against Europe.
The U.S. imported more than 245 million barrels of oil from Russia last year, according to government data. Natural Resources Defense Council's Strategic Engagement Director, Bob Deans, says experts have advocated for the U.S. to reduce its reliance on oil for years.
The oil industry has done everything it possibly can to prevent us from taking those common sense steps to break our dependence on this destructive fuel.
Education officials are hinting the Biden administration may further extend the freeze on federal student loan payments. It's been reported the White House instructed the companies that manage federal student loans to hold off on sending required notices to borrowers about their payments starting up. A federal appeals court panel has revived lawsuits seeking tuition and fee refunds from American University and George Washington University over closures of on-campus classes and activities in 2020 due to the pandemic. Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson was one of three judges who heard arguments in the cases. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
As we get closer to the May primary elections, is your voter registration up to date? As Suzanne Potter reports, good government groups have a few tips on making the voting process quick and easy.
The primary election is coming up in just 3 months, so it's time to make sure your voter registration is up to date. A lot of people moved during the pandemic, so you can update your records at registertovote.ca.gov. Ballots will be mailed to all registered voters in early May. Carol Moon Goldberg with the League of Women Voters says the biggest mistake people make is forgetting to sign the envelope.
Be sure to sign the envelope when the ballot is being returned. That has been traditionally the number one reason why a ballot has not been counted.
Legislative boundaries changed with redistricting, so you may find yourself in a different district with new candidates running. You'll find a trove of information on the Secretary of State's website or at the League of Women Voters site, which is votersedge.org. Moon Goldberg says the state takes multiple precautions to make sure the ballots are secure. Each ballot has a barcode, and the signature is matched with the one on file.
But the kind of paper, even the tint of the paper and a watermark is established by the Secretary of State's office. You can't go down to Kinko's FedEx and make a copy of one.
You can sign up for texts that track your ballot at wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov. The primaries are open. Candidates from all parties will appear on everyone's ballot. And the top two will compete in the general election, regardless of party affiliation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 10th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Bronwyn Clark, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegadoff, and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
The story told backwards now is that the coalition and other groups basically ended the rise of white supremacist groups in Oregon in the 90s. That's not at all true. We were part of an effort that broke the back of the neo-Nazi skinhead youth movement, which was a particular faction of the right. But we did not end white nationalist organizing here.
That was Scott Nakagawa from the Coalition for Human Dignity. What happened to this group of scrappy activists who for a few years in the early 90s, Portlanders saw on TV news every week fighting neo-Nazis? Where did the team of researchers stuffing filing cabinets with right-wing intelligence end up? What was their legacy? Welcome to episode 12 of It Did Happen Here, Less Booted, More Suited. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. In this episode, we tell the story of the